Hello, hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today, I'm here with Mr. John Kindervog. John, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Jacob. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing very well. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it. And folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review, all the things. Really helps me out. Thanks in advance. John, tell us about your background and how you got to where you are today.
I'm best known as the creator of Zero Trust. I was 8.5 years at Forrester Research. Coming up on 14 years ago, I wrote the first report on Zero Trust. It was called No More Chewy Centers. I did that after 2.5 years of primary research. And then from there, I've been at a couple of companies, and now I am the chief evangelist at a company called Illumio that focuses on zero trust segmentation for zero trust networks. So segmentation is something that I've always believed is critical to modern networking and modern cybersecurity. So I had an opportunity to join this company last fall. Jacob, a number of years ago, you know, I wrote a poem at the beginning of the IoT craze called Things Run Amok. And the subtitle was, If Dr. Seuss Could Comment Upon the Internet of Things. So you've asked for it, and here you go. You get poetry today, everybody. We live in a world all interconnected, but how in the world will it all get protected? Some bad boys and girls will try to infect it, making the internet all broken-necked. When Timmy B. Lee created the net, he just couldn't see it would be such a threat. People are nice, and they'll do the right thing. But wow, it turns out that people are mean. All of the futurists cackle with glee now that we've given each thing IP. IP, 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 a magical protocol that sets all things free. The Cat in the Hat had thing one and thing two. Think of the mischief that those two could do. But what if he had a thing three and thing four? More mischief they'll add as we add more and more. Soon we'll be so exceedingly thinged, it seems that the darn things have grown wings. A thing zillion of these will drive us all crazy, so we better make sure we don't all get lazy. What is a thing, I hear you dare ask? The effort of answering has become quite a task. A thing is something that's real, I would think, that whirls or spins, it moves or it blinks. A thing has a tiny computer that talks with other things, or even humans that walk. Maybe you control your thing from your phone and manage your thing when you're not at home. Some of your things I'm sure you will wear, wrapped on your arm or stuck in your hair. Some wish so hard for things they can drive, pushing bright buttons on a digital ride. Think of having things fill your kitchen. You'll tap on your iPad to make dinner. Your fridge is a thing that will keep your spam cold, but it will send spam out too if the hackers get hold. See, hackers will look for things they can break and then find some juicy data to take. Your data they will then turn into cash, and your reputation they will turn into trash. This is the future of things run amok if all that you do is rely on your luck. So put on your thing hat and think, 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 and consider your things that whirl, spin, or blink. Carefully protect your things from all hackers so that your company doesn't get smackered. It's a whole different world than when Timmy B. Lee created the web world for you and for me.
That is so awesome.
I wrote it a long, long time ago. And then somebody from the DOD asked me to recite it. And so it's just making a comeback. Like all great literature, it ebbs and it flows over time.
Talk to us about how network protection was typically approached before you did your research.
There's a lot of history there, but let's go back. For a long time, we designed networks without any security because there was a significant amount of time when there weren't any threats. And so it was all about moving packets across a bunch of different wires. I don't remember the exact year. I think 97, 98, 99. Robert Morris wrote the first ever piece of what we would call malware. It was called the Morris worm, and it spread all over tarnation and caused a lot of disruption. And the interesting thing about that was years before that, his father, who worked for the NSA, and I don't remember the timeline, but that would be an interesting thing for people listening and watching to look up. His father made the first testimony before Congress when he was working at the NSA saying, hey, we need to start protecting these networks because somebody's going to do something really bad. And in one of the great ironies of fate, it was his own son who did the bad thing. Yeah. So back then we weren't worried about protecting stuff. And then firewalls were invented probably about the same time, depends on who you talk to on who invented the first firewall. But that was in the mid, late 90s. And those firewalls had a thing called a trust model. And that trust model said that the internal network was the highest trust level of an interface. So the connection going to the internal network was the highest, most trusted interface. And that was generally given a trust level of 100. And of course, these are arbitrary numbers. And then the external network was the least secure, the most untrusted. It was actually called untrusted, and it was given a value of 0. And by rule, or by the way the logic in the policy engine worked, you needed a policy statement, a firewall rule, to go from a low trust level to a high trust level, so from the outside to the inside. But you did not need a rule to go from a high trust level to the low trust level, so going from the inside to the outside. No rule needed. My contention when I was installing firewalls a long, long time ago, 20 years or so, was that I need outbound rules, because what if somebody gets into the environment and then they're going to steal a bunch of data, exfiltrate it? I got in a lot of trouble for putting outbound rules. That's not the way you're supposed to do it. That's not how the manufacturer says to do it. That's a dumb idea. Don't do it. I fought against that because I said the trust level for every interface should be 0. And that's where zero trust comes from. We need to get rid of trust. Trust is a human emotion that's been injected into digital systems for absolutely no reason. You don't need this thing called trust, which most people can't define anyway, to move a packet from point A to point B. It's just irrelevant. And it causes a lot of problems. So most cybersecurity negative events can be deconstructed and traced back to that broken trust model. I talk a lot about Snowden and Manning. They're the Beyonce and the Zendaya of cybersecurity. They're so famous, they're one-word people. They were on trusted devices. They were trusted users. They had background checks. They had robust identity systems, really powerful MFA, and nobody looked at their packets once they'd authenticated. So they were able to go around, do a lot of malicious things, steal a lot of data, exfil it out because there were no outbound rules, really, depending upon which movie you watch. And then there were significant consequences. We got to be real careful on who we let access specific reasons. This was validated to me by a former federal prosecutor who was involved in this. And he said, John, I never understood zero trust and what you were trying to say until the Manning case crossed my desk. And I asked myself, how does a private first class in a forward operating base in Iraq have access to classified State Department cables stored in Washington, D.C.? And the answer was the trust model. Once you got on this specific, theoretically high security network, you got access to everything on it, whether you're a private first class or the president of the United States, it didn't matter. So the trust model is just all out of whack, Jacob. It's crazy. It'd be like I'm sitting in my house watching TV with my wife, and I look over and I go, hey, do you know who that is digging through my fridge over there? And she goes, no, I have no idea who it is. And I said, well, since they're able to get into the house and get access to the fridge, they must belong here. So will you go get some clean sheets? I'm going to make up the guest room and make them more comfortable. And we do that every single day in our organizations. We just make it more comfortable for the attackers. We make the assumption that if you're here, then you clearly are supposed to be here without asking the question, are you supposed to be here? We do that more in real life. I was once in London and I got a text message from a friend of mine. He said, I heard a rumor that you're in London. I texted back, yeah, I am. He said, you want to have dinner? And I said, sure. And he texted me a time and a place. And I show up to Gordon Ramsay's restaurant at Claridge Hotel in London. And I walk in. Everybody in this restaurant is in a tux. And I'm from Texas. So I'm wearing jeans, cowboy boots, and I got some kind of blazer on. And the maitre d' looked at me and he goes, are you supposed to be here? You know, he asked the right question. Are you supposed to be here? Something in the telemetry doesn't compute for me. I looked at my phone and I said, I'm meeting so-and-so for dinner tonight. And he said, oh, he's reserved the whole back room right this way. And as we were leaving and everybody was looking, because there was a little scene where he was being a little snippy. Finally, as we're walking back, he turns to me and he says, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He says, are you from the U.S.? And I said, yeah, I'm from Dallas. And he turned around and he raised his hands high above his head, almost like in a benediction. And he said, it's okay, everyone. He's a Texan. So he asked the right question. And then I gave the right response to the challenge. I'm from Texas. I get to go wherever I want.
That's great. I love that. You alluded to this earlier, your research at Forrester. Talk to us more about that and how you got to come up with the concept of zero trust.
When I was at Forrester, it was a very pure research shop. It was focused on research. I remember my first day in the new analyst class, our global research director wrote our job description on the whiteboard, and it was three words: think big thoughts. Mm-hmm. So you were encouraged to do things that were radical. and wild. I don't think I could have done something like this at any other place at any other time. Certainly, it wouldn't work at a company because if it didn't meet the product of the company was selling, no one would have wanted to publish it. It wouldn't have worked in academia because that's all about peer review and the peers would have said, no, you can't do it that way. That's all wrong. There had to be a lot of serendipity involved. And I was very lucky to get a job at Forrester and to work there for 8.5 years and to be there in sort of the prime of the research industry. And I still have a lot of friends there and a lot of friends at all the analyst firms. And there's a lot of value in those analyst firms as well. So it was a good time to be there. They just gave me a tremendous amount of freedom to think those big thoughts and come up with ideas and say things that sometimes were, well, not politically correct from the technological perspective. I would raise the hackles of a lot of different vendors and have a lot of people upset with me, but they enjoyed that. I mean, that was sort of the ethos. All vendors have a specific goal, which is to make money by selling product. And the goal at Forrester, we made money by selling research. And sometimes that aligned with what the vendor thought, and sometimes it didn't. And that was okay. In fact, you would get a lot more focus from a vendor if you said something that they didn't agree with than what they agreed with. So it was an interesting dynamic. It was almost like the vendor community disincentivized you to say nice things about them. And oddly enough, I did Illumio's first ever analyst interaction in 2013, the year they were founded. So I go back 10, 11 years with the founders and have been watching what they were doing for a long, long time.
When did the Zero Trust research start?
Formally, it started in 2008 when I joined Forrester and they asked me what I wanted to work on. And I kind of talked about this idea and they said, go for it. Right? Because I was really angry at the way I was being forced by vendors to install firewalls. I thought it was very unsafe and insecure. And so when I got there, I was like, okay, I'm going to try to take this down. And it wasn't well received by most people. A lot of people thought that I'd lost my mind. This will never work. No one's ever going to do it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 11 years later, the President of the United States actually issues an executive order saying, okay, everybody in the U.S. civilian side of the federal government has to do zero trust. So
yeah.
You know, that was something that I never anticipated, could never have imagined.
Hey everyone, Jacob here. Let me tell you about today's sponsor, Vanta. As the number and severity of third-party breaches continues to rise, companies are increasingly vigilant, not just about how they handle their own data, but how their vendors do as well. For compliance leaders, this means more security reviews are coming across your desk every day, and valuable time is being wasted on manual security reviews. With Vanta questionnaire automation, compliance teams can complete security reviews up to 5 times faster, giving you time back to focus on running your compliance programs. Over 8,000 global companies like ZoomInfo, SmartRecruiters, and Noibu use Vanta to save time on security reviews. Register for their upcoming webinar, Vanta in Action, questionnaire automation at vanta.com/GRC Academy. That's vanta.com/GRC Academy. Thanks and enjoy the rest of the episode. Give us a quick definition of zero trust from your standpoint.
Zero trust is a cybersecurity strategy, so it's not a product, designed to do two things. Number one, stop data breaches. And a data breach is defined by like the Verizon Data Breach Report or GDPR as when sensitive or regulated data has been exfiltrated from your networks or systems into the hands of a malicious actor. So it's about data going outbound. And then it does one other thing that's very important strategically, which is it stops other cybersecurity attacks from being successful. And it does this by eliminating the trust model in digital systems. So it's that simple. A lot of people try to overcomplicate it, and I just try to keep it simple. It's a strategy designed to stop data breaches by eliminating trust from digital systems. We could say it that quickly. And that has resonated up with leaders, right? Sometimes the technologists really, it makes them very uncomfortable because they just want to know what product to buy. And now you're making them think. When I talk to leaders, CEOs, members of boards of directors, admirals, generals, all kinds of people like that, they all get it because it was designed to strategically resonate with the highest level of any organization, yet be tactically implementable using commercially available off-the-shelf technology at whatever state that was in at that time. The strategy and the tactics were decoupled from each other on purpose because I knew that the strategy shouldn't change. We don't want strategies to change. And most people don't know what a strategy is. They confuse strategy and tactics all the time. we do want the tactics to get better and better. Those two things have proven to be true. That assertion that I had 16 years ago, I guess, probably was about when I did the first Zero Trust speech. I did a bunch of research. I test marketed it in a bunch of speeches. The most significant ones were 5 speeches down the East Coast, starting in Montreal, ending in Atlanta. And they were all at these very high-end Lynx golf courses, Scottish-style golf courses, because one guy at a vendor wanted to play these courses and he needed a crazy idea to throw out there. And it just went over really, really well. And I lost about 8 million golf balls that trip because, man, the rough is that tall grass that you see it when they're in, you know, St. Andrews. And man, you cannot chip out of that stuff. I about ripped my arms off once.
Now, you outlined 5 steps to get to Zero Trust. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. The first thing I want to say is I was very lucky because for a number of years, I was the only person in the world designing and overseeing the implementation of Zero Trust environments. I consider that a great blessing because I got to make a ton of mistakes so that you don't have to. And then I documented those and wrote about them and published them and created methodologies around them and gave speeches so that it's going to be easier for you than if everybody would have just jumped on the bandwagon right away. So that was the real benefit of that. But the first step is to define, what are you trying to protect? So the protect surface is the inversion of the attack surface. Everybody talks about managing their attack surface, but you can't. What they really mean is I'm going to get a little bit of visibility into what stuff you have exposed, but it's not really workable because the attack surface is like the universe. It's constantly expanding. By inverting that problem and saying, okay, I'm not going to care about all the other stuff. I'm just going to care about a few things that I need to protect. And so I can shrink the attack surface down orders of magnitude to something very small and easily known called a protect surface. So that's the first thing to understand. And so we take what's known as a DAS element, a little acronym to help you remember what goes in a protect surface. That stands for data, applications, assets, or services. You put a single DAS element in a single protect surface and build your Zero Trust environment one protect surface at a time. Yeah. Everything is dependent upon the concept of protect surface. If you don't understand that, you don't understand Zero Trust. And then the second step is mapping the transaction flows. How does the system work together as a system? You have to have visibility into the function of the system in order to protect it. And I learned this the hard way when somebody took out a server because it was old and the entire environment went down. And of course, they blamed it on Zero Trust. We shouldn't have been doing the Zero Trust stuff. And I'm like, no, that bozo shouldn't have been taking out a server in the middle of the night just because it was old without asking, what is its function?
Yeah.
The function was pretty darn important. And so I learned a lesson there. And then the third step is we architect the environment. So every Zero Trust environment is custom built for the protect surface. In the past, we started with a reference architecture that was very generic, and we forced the business to fit what they wanted to accomplish into that architecture, and that never worked. I advocate understanding what you need to protect, how it works, and that will show you almost magically what controls you need to put in place. Step 4 is to write policy, because everything is about policy. Ultimately, Zero Trust is a policy statement. I need to have controls that can enforce that policy. And then step 5 is monitor and maintain, where I bring all the telemetry, all the signals back into the system to make it better and better. This is known as anti-fragility. There's a great book by Nissim Nicholas Taleb called Anti-Fragile, who gave me the vocabulary to talk about what I've been trying to do. He talks about systems that get stronger and stronger under stress or under load. The human body is a great example. You know, you go on vacation, you have too many steaks, lay around too much, you get home, need to take off a couple of pounds. I've got a diet, stresses my body. I'm going to exercise. All those things stress my body, but my body is an anti-fragile system, so it gets stronger and stronger under stress, under load. And we can make networks like that using Zero Trust, leveraging what's happening in step 5.
How about misconceptions about Zero Trust?
Oh, yeah. I've published a lot on the misconceptions of Zero Trust, and there's 4 primary ones. The first misconception is Zero Trust means we're going to make a system trusted, and that's not true. We're trying to eliminate trust. Trust is always a bad thing, right? So I tell customers, you have to break yourself of a habit of thinking of this term trust. So put a trust jar out on the table, right? And anytime anybody uses that word as a good thing inside of the digital realm, put a dollar, put a pound, put a euro in it, and you'll start to break yourself of the habit of using that word because it's what's known as a plastic word, a word we throw around without understanding the meaning of it. It's always a bad thing in digital systems, always a bad thing in digital systems. Just no way around it. It leads to all the data breaches that we have. So that's the first thing. The second thing is probably that zero trust is hard and complicated, and it's not. It's very simple. We've already talked about the five-step model. Lots of people make it hard. I don't know why they make it hard, but they do. They make it much harder to understand, much harder to do than it needs to be. It's just very simple. The third is that you can buy zero trust, that it's a product, and it's not. You can't buy a product and get there. You have to create it as a system, a project, and you're never done with it, by the way. I did an interview with a publication in Singapore last night. They were asking, well, you know, we're not seeing a lot of people being finished with zero trust. Well, that's right. You're never going to be finished with it. It'd be like, well, boy, I've breathed a lot in my life. I better be done breathing. Why am I still breathing? I must be a failure at breathing, right? No, as soon as you stop breathing, you die. If you stop doing this, you're just going to be hacked out of business. It's kind of the same thing. You'll never be finished because it's a living, organic thing. And then kind of the biggest misconception about zero trust is that it's all about identity. You just do multi-factor authentication. No. I already mentioned Beyonce and Zendaya, right? Our two famous hackers. And so no, identity is consumed within zero trust. It's not equivalent to it. And this is a deliberate misconception made by identity vendors when they first heard about it. Oh, we can spin that message. And well, it is what it is. You know, it's not anything to be angry about, but it is a misconception. And when people understand it, then they go, oh, I see why. Because quite frankly, if identity was the answer, Snowden and Manning had this phenomenally powerful identity system. Their multi-factor authentication is much more powerful and strong than anything that we use, but it's really cumbersome and complex and everybody hates it. And nobody in the private sector would keep their job if they had to use what they use in the federal government. They would all go, I'll go find somebody else who doesn't use that.
Now, looking at some of the federal agencies that have put out pillars from user, device, to data, and network, and environment, and automation, orchestration, all those things. What are your thoughts on that approach?
The pillars were originally designed by my friend Chase Cunningham as the ZTX framework at Forrester. And they were designed to help you understand what technology potentially might go into a particular protect surface to protect a particular thing. There's just been a lot of misunderstanding of the usefulness of them or the purpose behind it. And so sometimes it overcomplicates things because they go in a certain order visually. Everybody thinks, well, I need to do identity first and I can't move on and do anything else until I've finished identity, but you'll never finish identity. So therefore the maturity, if you're going in that way, instead of the five-step model, your maturity level is going to be very low. But if you do it per protect surface in the five steps, you can have high maturity in one protect surface and low maturity in other protect surfaces. And that's probably going to be fine, especially early on in your journey, because you got to do it one at a time. It's like remodeling a house, right? Unless you're going to be on one of those TV shows where 300 people come in over the weekend and remodel your house in one weekend, it's going to take a long time and you're going to do it one room at a time. So there's a lot of things that have to be done sequentially, and zero trust is like that.
Normally, we have different systems for those different areas. One system might be evaluating the compliances of devices. Another system might be evaluating user behavior, things like that. But you say that we can apply that five-step model you outlined earlier to every one of those, correct?
Right, sure. And you shouldn't be looking at a single data point to make a decision. You have to have lots of different data points. Like when I was at Gordon Ramsay's, people with cowboy boots can't come into the restaurant, except the person I was going to go see was spending the most money that was going to be spent that day at that restaurant. If you have more data about the context of the access request, then you can know whether to allow or deny. You can't make any decision just on one small piece of information without a lot of contextual value around that.
Let's say a small business wants to adopt zero trust and implement it within their environment. Maybe they're pure cloud. Microsoft holds all their data, all the good stuff. And maybe they don't even have cybersecurity expertise. How can a small business effectively implement zero trust and do it in a way that's affordable? And how could they do that?
There's a number of different ways, but you still use the same five steps. You certainly better know what important data or assets you need to protect. Okay, this is stored in, you know, Microsoft Azure. So how do I protect it? We have a solution for that. Lots of people have solutions that provide that protection. You can also outsource a lot of that to a managed service. Good managed services have a deep understanding of zero trust. And that's a really good way for a small business that doesn't have a lot of expertise to do it. Now, one thing you have to understand is that cybersecurity costs money. it's a bad thing to be thinking of it as a cost center. It's not. It is a fundamental thing that runs your business. As we're recording this, we're in the middle of the CrowdStrike, where they struck out a bunch of businesses, right? And however that happened, no interest in discussing that. But for example, one of my coworkers is stuck, I think, visiting family in another state from where she works. I often say, right, if you think about cybersecurity and technology itself as a cost center, which everybody thinks of IT and cyber as cost centers, then you're missing the boat. Because if you are an airline, you have the three things that an airline needs, the three Ps. You have planes, passengers, and pilots. Used to be that's all you needed. I mean, when I was young, tickets were handwritten. The only computers that existed were in that business were for air traffic controllers and radar operators. There were no centralized ticketing systems. I knew the guy who built the first ever one for American Airlines called Sabre here in Dallas back in the late 70s, early 80s. And so you could run an airline without a computer. But now she's stuck in another city because the computer system is down. The planes are there. The pilots are there. The passengers are there. There's fuel on them planes, but nobody can take off because the computational systems aren't working. So this is not a cost center. It is integral to your business survival. And that's what people don't get yet. From an accounting perspective, it becomes problematic because everybody's worried about the CapEx. How much is this going to cost to acquire? The acquisition cost is very small compared to the long-term care and feeding of the technology. And it's a trivial amount compared to all the lawsuits you're going to have after some incident. So we would say what's happening right now is an incident disrupting availability of the systems, even though it's not a traditional hack, probably. We have to understand that there's going to be lawsuits, legal fees, there's going to be business downtime. How many millions of dollars are the airlines losing because they can't fly passengers around? And so the cost associated with the negative consequences of doing this poorly are astronomical compared to the cost of acquiring the technology and doing it right the first time.
Yeah, and that's so true. If you were talking to a CEO, what would be your business case for adopting Zero Trust?
You got important stuff that you need to protect. Here's how you do it.
Simple as
that.
They
all get it. I mean, I've never had a CEO go, yeah, I don't understand it. I have a standard pitch that I give them, but they all want to know, how do I protect this thing? How do I protect that thing? Since we're on the GRC Academy podcast here, and I'm not really a GRC person per se, but I would like to tell a little interesting story about having the first ever audit done of a Zero Trust environment.
Yeah.
This happened a long time ago, but it's a fascinating story. I got a call from the client representative at Forrester who managed a particular account. It's a very large account. And they had built an early Zero Trust environment. The CIO needs you on the phone immediately. And this person was freaked out because usually calls were scheduled a couple of weeks in advance. But when there was an emergency call, get on the phone now, that was never a good thing. And then I got, well, they just did an audit of the Zero Trust network that you helped design and manage the implementation of. I'm like, I never really thought about that, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it's just like, it was this moment of kind of horror, like what is going to come out? The CIO gets on the call and he just starts, okay, John, I don't know how to tell you this. And he goes on and on. And we just had the auditors come in and they spent 7 days testing everything in the Zero Trust environment and blah, blah, blah. And it's going on for a fair bit. And I'm feeling the butterflies in my stomach. And I said, just tell me what happened. Just tell me what happened. And he said, we had zero audit findings. And I said, oh, you could have started with that. And he said, no, it was way more fun to just wind you up. And he said, John, if I would have known that I would have gotten zero audit findings on this, I would have done this before. I would have done this way earlier. This paid for itself easily, right? And he said, there were three pieces of feedback we got from the auditors. One is, they said, we can understand this Zero Trust thing. It's very understandable, very simple. We could never understand all that stuff you would give us with all these reports and Visio diagrams, and none of that made sense. Two, clearly, wherever this came from, because they didn't know anything about me, there was a lot of compliance mandates built into it. For the most part, we could just check off all these things. And then for everything that we found that wasn't done here, we realized that's not applicable for this type of environment. So we just put NA, NA, NA. So you've got zero findings. Zero findings on a pretty large estate managing some very significant and sensitive data. auditors tend to love Zero Trust because they do understand it and it speaks their language. And as a former QSA, as somebody who's been building environments that were designed to achieve certain compliance requirements for a long time, that just is designed into it. That's one of the groups of people that I like to be in front of because they get it and can push it forward. So I just thought that not being a GRC person specifically, but your audience might enjoy a little anecdote there.
Can you give us some advice for the newer people coming into IT and cybersecurity?
Yeah, get hands-on experience in the real world doing IT, doing cybersecurity, learn the OSI model, learn TCP/IP, learn how everything works. And you have to do it experientially. You have to get your hands on machines and configure things and do things in reality. You can't learn this in a book. You can't learn it in school. I try to help people all the time. You know, so-and-so has a PhD in cybersecurity, but they can't get a job. Why? Because they don't have any real-world practical experience. And academia, what you learn there doesn't translate over to world problems that we're having in cybersecurity today.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that as GRC professionals, we also need to be technical. I see some folks who come into the GRC world and they don't have the background of understanding how systems work and things like that. You know, this is in the weeds, but when it comes to assessing risk of vulnerabilities or whatever, having that technical background just pays off so much. So in complete agreement there.
Yeah, you wouldn't want your person auditing your car safety or something to not know how automobiles work. It's the same thing, right?
This has been awesome. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for sharing with us. To me, Zero Trust is a lot more simple than I ever thought it was. Any last thoughts you'd like to leave with us?
Probably the last thought is there's no prerequisites for doing Zero Trust. You don't have to fix anything or finish anything. Mm-hmm. Wherever you are is where you should start. Start your journey now. You can start anywhere, anytime, any place. It doesn't matter. It's the same whether it's in a cloud, on-premise, on endpoint. It doesn't matter. None of those things matter. A lot of people spend a lot of time worrying about things that don't matter. What matters is protecting your data, your assets, your network, all that kind of stuff, those DAS elements. And you do that by putting them in a protect surface and then follow that 5-step model and you will succeed.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jacob. Appreciate it.